Okay, so we're continuing with our second installment of the Mussar Musing series. Thank everybody for coming. And I want to talk about Asar B'Teves. It's going to be this Friday. Very unique fast day. One of the only fast days that can fall out the way it does. And that's a story for another time. I actually didn't want to talk about that. But Asar B'Teves is something that we keep every single year. And the reasons why we keep it are actually explicitly stated as soon as we start the Slichos. When we start Slichos, we recite a piyut already from the very beginning. Eskra Matzok Asher Kara Ani. The three tragedies that we mourn as to why Asar B'Teves was established. So what are those three tragedies? We say it in the opening piyut. Shalosh Makos B'Chodesh Zehi Kani. We've been struck, we've been punished with three particular tragedies in this on this day, in this month that we're commemorating Asar B'Teves. So what are the three tragedies? So the one that's most famous, that we're all very well aware of, is the Siege of Yerushalayim. The Siege of Yerushalayim began in Asar B'Teves. We were surrounded by our enemies. Okay? The death of Ezra Sofer, also what we described. Ezra Sofer, one of the greatest leaders in Jewish history. The death of Ezra Sofer is partially what we commemorate on Asar B'Teves, what we mourn on Asar B'Teves. And the last one is the Targum Shivim Mishnayim. Basically, the creation of the Septuagint. When Ptolemy HaMelech brought together Chachmei Yisrael, it's described in the Gemara Megillah and Daf Tes. Ptolemy HaMelech brought in the Chachmei Yisrael, put them into individual rooms, and told them to translate the Torah into Greek. And that is actually the origins of the initial translation of the Old Testament into Greek. So just some quick historical background before we go further, in terms of establishing who Ptolemy HaMelech was. So Alexander the Great obviously conquers a huge swath of land, one of the greatest military commanders in history, possibly the best. And he dies very early in 323 BCE. Civil war broke out immediately after he died. Different generals vying for power. Eventually, I think the head of his cavalry was the one who ended up winning out the political intrigue. He ended up splitting up the kingdom amongst many different generals. It split up into amongst many different people. And there were major chunks taken by various different people. Ptolemy, one of the generals of Alexander, took Egypt. So he was the one who took control of Egypt. He started his own dynasty. The Seleucid Empire, who are famous enemies from the Syrian Greek story of Hanukkah, he took over Syria. So Eretz Yisrael is basically right in the middle of those two dynasties, the Seleucid dynasty and the Ptolemy dynasty, and they were constantly a tug of war, constant power struggle that many times waged across Eretz Yisrael over the course of the years. So Eretz Yisrael was under the control of the Seleucids in the times of Hanukkah, obviously, that's what happened, the Syrian Greeks. And in many cases, they were under the control of the Egyptians, of the Egyptian Greeks, the Ptolemy monarchs. So the second Ptolemy, the second, he was the monarch who called for the Septuagint translation. He was the one who called the Chachmei Yisrael in and had them translate the Torah Shebiksav, the written Torah, into Greek. So with that historical background, let's analyze this for a little bit. It makes sense why we mourn for the Siege of Yerushalayim. That makes total sense to us. It makes sense why we'll mourn the death of Ezra Sofer. Ezra Sofer is one of the greatest leaders that Klal Yisrael has ever had. He's the one who brought us back from Galus Bavel. He's one of the greatest Torah scholars in our history. And the accomplishments that he had for Klal Yisrael are unparalleled. So it makes sense that we'd be mourning on the day that he passed away. What about the translation? Targum Shivim Mishnayim. Compared to every other tragedy that we commemorate on other fast days, it seems like quite a walk in the park, actually. It actually seems really nice. A translation of the Torah into Greek. Is that really so bad? And let's add to the question a little bit. I don't know of anybody who fasts on the day that Art Scroll Publications was founded, or when the Stone Chumash was finally published. They tear Kriya and they sit on the floor and have a fast day. I like the Stone Chumash. It's very nice. I grew up with it. Very nice. Vartlach on the bottom. It's a beautiful translation. I'm a big fan. What's the big deal with the translation of the Torah that we're so worried about it, that we're commemorating its translation? Doesn't really fit. To add to the question a little bit, let's think about it for a second. This is a great trivia question. If anybody wants to speak up. Who was the first person to translate the Torah into Greek? If anybody wants to take a guess. First person. You can get very creative with the guess. Moshe Rabbeinu was the first person to translate the Torah into Greek, 100%. You look at Rashi, it's explicit in Rashi. Perek Aleph of Sefer Devarim. Behavior Yardin, Be'eretz Moav, Hoil Moshe, Be'eretz HaTorah, Azostei Mor. What does Be'eretz HaTorah mean, says Rashi? What does it mean that Moshe Rabbeinu starts saying over the Torah to Klal Yisrael? Beshivim Lashon Pir Shalahem. Moshe Rabbeinu translated the Torah into all 70 languages, and I guarantee you that amongst those 70 languages is Greek. Moshe Rabbeinu was the first person to translate the Torah into all 70 languages, including Greek. And as was mentioned, as Rabbi Donat just mentioned, if you look at later in Sefer Devarim, when we have the command to write the Torah onto these massive stones at Har Gerizim Har Eival, we're commanded to write Ksav Tal Avanim as Kol Devrei HaTorah Azos Be'er Hetev, to write near these two places, Har Gerizim Har Eival, these massive stones, as Kol Devrei HaTorah Azos Be'er Hetev, to write onto the Torah all of these words, to write onto these stones all these words of the Torah, with a Be'er Hetev, says Rashi again, consistently translating the word Be'er as B'Shivim Lashon. So Yoshua, when he brought Klal Yisrael across the Eber HaYarden at Har Gerizim Har Eival, translated the Torah into all 70 languages. We were commanded to do so. And not only that, the Torah describes that it was a great commotion of Simcha, there was V'samachta, they shechted Karbonos, and they rejoiced. It was a great event of Simcha. V'zabachta shlamim v'achalta shem v'samachta v'tnei Hashem Elokecha. It generated a great happiness that we were translating the Torah onto these stones. What's going on over here? The Sinsei Chachamim says on the spot that the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to translate the Torah was so that all the nations could learn from its wisdom. Sheyuchlu ha'umos ta'atika. According from the Gemara Sota, the whole point of this was that the Chachmei ha'umos would be able to learn the Torah, but to know Torah Shebiksav. And we're mourning the fact that somebody was interested enough to ask us to translate it into Greek? Everybody hear the question? What's going on over here? It's very strange. It's bizarre. So the translation doesn't only seem to be a big deal, but it was done by Moshe Rabbeinu himself, the person who was makabel the Torah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He already had translated it. There's a small but crucial distinction between the Targum of Moshe Rabbeinu and the Targum of Shivim Mishnayim, the 72 Torah scholars who were told to translate the Torah into Greek. And this is a very important idea that I think we have to be thinking about a lot, especially in our day and age. In the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, Klal Yisrael were spiritually on fire. They were on the march. They were ready to show the entire world what the wisdom of the Torah truly means. It was time to project our values, and no better way than to translate the Torah, Shebek Sav, into the languages of all the nations and project our values to the entire outside world. That was the way that we were going to show the entire world of how valuable the Torah truly is. And the wisdom of Klal Yisrael and of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We were going to share it. We were insiders, we were confident in our values, we were confident in the wisdom of the Torah. We knew that the world needs this Torah. The world needs the values of Yiddishkeit. It needs the values of Torah Shebiksav. And that's why we translated it. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to translate it. And that's the reason why there was a great simcha and commotion when we did. But let's fast forward all the way to the times of the second Bayis Sheni. The world has come under the dominion of Greek culture. Bnei Yisrael are under control of foreign powers. They're slowly projecting their values onto us. The Greek Hellenization process has already begun. And slowly but surely, their values are being projected onto us instead of the other way around. And now comes along a very powerful Greek king and demands that the Torah be translated into Greek. Essentially, what was Ptolemy saying? He was saying that he wants to judge the Torah for himself. Is it really so special? Does it really have so much to offer? How does it compare to Greek culture? You know, you say so many great things about it. Is it really so special? Is it really so much better than what I already have? And Ptolemy says, I want to see it for myself. Translate it into my words. Translate it into my perspective. Into my culture. I want to be able to read it under my terms. What that essentially means is on Asar B'Teves, we weren't only besieged literally. We were besieged figuratively, metaphorically speaking. There are outsiders now peering into our walls, and they are determining whether what we have is valuable. The tragedy of the Targum Shivim Mishnayim is that now the Torah is expected to conform itself to the modern age, to use the dominant language and culture in order to be able to communicate its values. And if it doesn't, it doesn't have value. I get to determine whether it speaks to me. I get to determine whether it has value or not. If it conforms to my perspectives, to my moral code, to my milieu, then that probably means that it has value. And if it doesn't do that, then it's valueless, and there's no reason for me to even pay any attention to it. So translate it into my terms, and I'll see whether it really has everything that people claim it does. It's a debasement of the Torah's sanctity. The Torah is the essence of the Ribono Shel Olam kiviyachol in this world. It doesn't need to prove itself to anybody. When the Torah Kadosha has to debase itself with somebody being able to determine whether it truly has value or not, that's when it means that the Torah has been debased, its sanctity has been kiviyachol, as if spat upon by those on the outside, be able to determine whether they think it's valuable or not. And here's the worst part about when we get surrounded, especially when the Torah gets surrounded. Jews themselves start viewing the Torah as outsiders. We start viewing the Torah as outsiders. We get influenced by outside cultures. Their values are projected onto us, and we start reconsidering whether what we have actually has value. When you're heavily exposed to Hellenization and to modern culture, we start comparing the Torah to alternatives. That's when Galus Yavin begins. The exile of Greek culture. You can live in Eretz Yisrael and still be a part of Galus Yavin. In fact, Galus Yavin was when we were in Eretz Yisrael. The Galus is when we become exiled from our own foundational values. We become exiled from Torah. We become exiled from our foundation of Nasiv and Nishma that we unquestioningly will always pursue the Rebbe Shalom's wisdom no matter what happens. That's what we became exiled from, and that's what, to some extent, today in age, we're still exiled from. We lose sight of the Emunah and Mesorah that grounded us in the first place. Now the Torah has to compete with alternatives, that's to prove its worth. It has to win over the loyalty of the Jewish people. Forget about the outside world. Now the Torah has to prove to the Jews themselves that it's valuable, that it's worth following. Our ancestors didn't need the Torah to prove anything. Nasa Benishma is all we needed. Kadosh Baruch Hu's wisdom, it's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Torah, Nasa Benishma, we're in. It doesn't need to justify itself to us. But when Galus Yavin is around, when Asar B'Teves occurs, and we get surrounded, and now we're expected to translate the Torah into their terms, that's when we lose sight of what the Torah truly is. Let's talk about this a little bit and translate into our terms for today's day and age. There's always a danger in Galus of becoming an outsider to our own Torah, especially when we're literally in Galus and we're not supposed to live in Eretz Yisrael. We join the non-Jews besieging the wall. We literally become people who are surrounding the walls of Yerushalayim, and we start becoming the people who judge and try to even modify the Torah so that it conforms a little more to what the outside world expects it to say, what the outside world expects it to believe. That's when Jews start feeling apologetic about their Mesorah. We start judging the Torah. We try to conform it to the modern trends. We're ashamed of it. We get feelings of inferiority. This is the first danger when it comes to becoming an outsider. This is something that the Rav Zatzal used to talk about at length. Very famously, I'll read a quote from it right now. He spoke about women's issues in this particular context, and this, I'll read the quote as I have it. "We must not yield," said the Rav. I mean emotionally, it is very important. "We must not feel inferior, experience or develop an inferiority complex, and because of that complex, yield to the charm. Usually it is a transient and passing charm of modern political and ideological svaros." Okay, I say not only to compromise, certainly not to compromise, but even not to yield emotionally. Skipping down. "There is no need for apology. We should have pride in our Mesorah and our heritage. And of course, certainly it goes without saying that one must not try to compromise with these cultural trends. And one must not try to gear the halachic norm to the transient ways of a neurotic society, which is what our society is." Now, the Rav spoke about this a very long time ago. Our society is irrational, said the Rav. We don't need to feel apologetic for the trends that society has set. We should be prideful in our Mesorah, and we should never feel apologetic for what we believe in. And the danger of when we get surrounded by the enemy, and when we're expected to translate the Torah into Greek, or whatever culture or language is expecting us to translate that Torah, is that we start thinking that the Torah needs to conform, or we are apologetic at least, and ashamed of the fact that it hasn't. And we have to hide our beliefs. We have to be nervous about it. I'm going to digress for a second. I wanted to talk about why Jews should feel more confident in their Mesorah generally, and maybe a way of combating this sense of gullus from our own Mesorah, of feeling exiled from our own values. What we need to recognize is why society is so deeply irrational, and that I think helps us recognize of why we should be clinging to the Mesorah. I'm a very big fan of Jonathan Haidt. I've quoted him in the past. His research is incredible. I recommend his books. He's an incredible, sociologist, psychologist, whatever it is that you want to call him. But I recommend his book. Righteous Minds is one of his main books. But I actually got exposed to him when he came to YU, when it must have been my third year in YU. Life-changing event, his presentation. Fascinating presentation that he gave on his article that I read, The Dog and Its Rational Tail. He basically tries to note that nobody actually thinks logically about some of the most basic moral questions that exist in American society. And I'll give some examples from some experiments that he did. He basically poses the moral dilemmas or questions, or at least a questionable act that somebody did, and asks people to tell him whether it's immoral or whether it was moral. And then he asks them to explain why. So I'll give you some examples. One example that he likes to do is you have an elderly couple who've been married for many years, and the husband is dying. And the wife is distraught about it, and the husband just keeps on telling her, I want you to do whatever makes you happy. Just do whatever makes you happy. I want you to forget about me. Just I want you to be happy. And he passes away. And she's so distraught. She's so upset. But you know, she was thinking that she always wanted to be able to taste human flesh. So she decided, like, look, makes me happy. Why not? And she took a piece of her husband, and she ate it. Is that... Yeah, exactly. I can see the faces. Some of the faces, and I can hear some of the noises. It's gross, right? Disgusting. How immoral and wrong. So he asked people to say, why is it immoral? Why is it wrong? And you'll be very surprised or disturbed by how many Americans cannot explain why they think that is wrong. They'll start searching for reasons. He uses the central metaphor of the elephant and the rider. The elephant is the more base sub-processes that already goes in a certain direction because it already knows where it's supposed to go. Society does not find that to be acceptable, and for sure, that's immoral, right? And then the upper processes try catching up and explaining why that's the case. And if the first reason falls flat, they'll come up with another reason, and come up with another reason. It's immoral because people will see and they'll get very upset at her. No, nobody sees her. Nobody saw her. She did it by herself. She'll be distraught later. That's the reason why it's wrong, because she'll be really upset. But no, she wasn't upset. She feels great about herself. She lives on Me'av Esrim, and she's very happy with what she did. And they desperately search for reasons. No, because the doctor, and because the neighbor, and the children. No, no children, no doctor, nothing. They can't explain why it's wrong. He gives some, believe it or not, even more disturbing cases. He talks about incest between a brother and sister. Ask people why they think it's wrong. Nothing. They cannot explain for the life of them. It's wrong because of genetics. No, no genetic problems. They're both infertile. No children. Nothing. It's going to make them feel in conflict with each other. Family. No, they feel great. Everybody's fine. Nobody's hurt. He shows how we can't explain why we think what we think. We can't explain why things are moral or immoral. Americans are deeply inconsistent when it comes to applying these principles of morality. And if you think a little hard enough, you can come up with many internal inconsistencies when it comes to the certain mores that we take for granted that are obviously true. And Americans can't explain it. They can't. And he tries to prove, based off that we're not really thinking when we come up with our moral stances. Many people in society aren't actually thinking when they determine what is considered moral or immoral. It has more to do with what society deems to be so and cultural standards that were created over the last 50 years, 60 years, not even, in some cases 20. That's what morality is based off of in America. It's inspiring if you look, it's also sad, but if you look at Jews who have been writing for literally thousands of years, Jews who became outsiders to their own Masorah, and they write about how things are done and Judaism is done and it's old, it's antiquated, and it needs to change. Or in some cases, this is the new Weltanschauung, this is the new perspective, this is the way to become moral and upstanding. And all those people who abandoned the Masorah got thrown themselves into the waste bins of history, maybe 60, 100 years later. Their own great-grandchildren perceive them as barbarians. And it goes back and forth, and the same trends that occurred 1,000 years ago come back in 200 years, and everything is a Kohelis-esque moment of Ein Kadosh Tachas HaShemesh. And there's only one thing that remains constant, and that is the Masorah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the wisdom of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What other choices did you have but to cling to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Chachma? What other choice do you have? As if people are thinking critically for themselves in determining what's considered moral or not? For the most part, that's not the case. Scientifically, it's not true. And we can talk about his research more. I recommend his book, Righteous Minds. So look through his research. You'll see it's such a strong, I would say it's a chizuk to any Jew who wants to recognize why it's so important to cling to the Masorah. I'll quote something from the Hakdama Madregas Adam. We actually quoted from it last time. The altar of Navardik. This time it's his Talmidim who wrote a Psichas Davar. They wrote an introduction. And keep in mind that the Talmidim of the altar of Navardik went through the worst of the worst. They went through two world wars after he passed away after World War I. They lived through World War II. They lived through communism. There's a very famous chilling story where the altar was trying to get messages across to his Talmidim, and he had to decode them, so he would have to put coding into it so that the communist officials wouldn't be able to figure out what he was trying to say. He was on the other side. Many of his Talmidim were still caught under communism, under the Bolsheviks, and he was trying to get messages across. And sometimes it would literally have to be like just two words in the middle of a message. They'd be able to figure it out what it was. So they asked him what to do because they were trying to close down the yeshivas. They were trying to close down the yeshivas, trying to break down Yiddishkeit permanently, trying to eradicate it. And he sent back a letter, but inside that letter were two words that they knew were intended for them. Av Harachamim. Merciful Father. So what does that mean? They understood what it meant. He was referencing the tefillah that we say on Shabbos, which commemorates all of the martyrs. Av Harachamim. So he knew he was referring to the martyrs who had perished at the hands of those who hate Klal Yisrael for thousands of years. And the story goes that when these Talmidim got the message, they were learning in yeshiva, official soldiers came in, said, we're closing right now, get out right now. And the Rosh Yeshiva came up, unbuttoned his shirt, opened his shirt and said, shoot. And everybody lined up after him and they unbuttoned their shirts and they opened up their shirts and said, shoot. Now, you wouldn't necessarily believe this, but if you knew Nevardik, you would believe it. Nevardikers were fiery beyond. They were totally, absolutely dedicated to the Rebbe, to the altar, and they would do wild, crazy things. They were totally Bali Bitachon. That's a story for another time. The altar had a very radical perspective on Bitachon in general, where if you believe that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to take care of you, he will take care of you. Very intense perspective towards Bitachon. So they literally just opened up their shirts and said, shoot. And the soldier was either so impressed or so shaken, soldiers just left. They let them be. Those are the Talmidim, the altar and the Vardak. And they write in the Hakdama to his Sefer, to his magnum opus. They say, they quote from the Pasuk of Yeshaya, in Yeshaya, that the Rishayim are kiyam nigrash, like a raging sea, with waves and waves. And they explain that no matter what, every single generation, there's always a massive wave that thinks it's going to overtake the shore, and it's going to change history forever. It's this new perspective on morality, this new perspective of the outside world. And Jews join the wave. They become outsiders to their own Masorah. And they now have seen the light. They know what it truly means to be a moral, upstanding person. And they join the wave. And what always happens is that the wave hits the shore, crashes with a mighty burst of power, and disappears and dissipates, never to be seen again. And then the next couple of years, another wave, and another wave. And it would be easy for them to write this if they were living in Eretz Yisrael after Hakamas Medina, where Torah is flourishing. They were living in a time where Torah was dying. Everybody thought Torah was dying. Communists were closing down everything. They lived through two world wars. They lived through the worst of the worst. And with utter confidence, they said, this wave will pass. It will always break. And the only thing that will be left is the Torah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Torah of Kadosha. With utter confidence, the galam shebayam einam lom demei galam shelefneim. The waves never learn from the waves that are in front of them. Kena rashal yilma mikakulo shelefanav. So too, the Rishayim never learn from those who have failed before them. They're never going to succeed. They'll never stop us, and they'll always fail. Powerful words coming from Jews who are at the bottom of what you could perceive the most bottom depths of galus, and they knew the truth. Connecting to the Masorah is the only way to achieve true connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, true morality, and with utter confidence, no matter how many movements were around them, they clung to that Masorah. I think there's a second issue when it comes to becoming an outsider. Going back to the issues that we were talking about before, of becoming the person who's surrounding as opposed to the person who's on inside of the walls. We're Central Orthodox Jews. We believe that there's value to outside culture. We believe in science, math, literature. I'm a Talmud of Rav Lichazin Zatzal and his Talmidim. Of course we believe in the value of all those things. Studying Chachma improves our lives as Avdei Hashem. That's what the point of it is. That's why we do it. It improves us as Jews. Here's the issue. You can only determine what's actually valuable as an Eved Hashem when you're an insider, when you're inside the walls. You can't start determining what's valuable for a frum Jew when you're standing outside the walls trying to translate the Torah into the terms that you want it to be translated into. When you want the Torah to speak the Greek language and the Greek philosophy and the Greek culture, and you project that onto the Torah, or you even meld the Torah just a little bit to conform more to your standards, you're going to end up taking things from the outside world that really don't belong on the inside. And I'm going to quote from Rav Lichtenstein that's all on this point. I recommend By His Light to everybody. By His Light is an incredible work. It's also much more accessible than some of Rav Lichtenstein's other works because he didn't write it. It was in speech form. So his writing is incredible, a little more difficult to decode at times. By His Light is speeches. And he has several incredible pieces here. probably one that we're going to quote from a lot because it's a spiritual accounting of Centrist Orthodoxy, is his article on Centrist Orthodoxy at the end of the book. So I recommend it. But he talks about the possibility of integrating secular society or elements of secular society into Torah life. And he talks about how to do that. I'm going to read a little bit from it right now. Now, of course, and this cannot be reiterated too strongly, there are all kinds of caveats. The proper balance must be maintained. Great care needs to be taken that improper or pernicious influences do not seep in. And we must always approach general culture critically from a Torah perspective. I'm going to repeat that. We must always approach general culture critically from a Torah perspective. From a Torah perspective. But when that is done, the ability to incorporate something of general culture into the Torah world clearly exists. Rav Lichtenstein goes on to quote a beautiful halachic parallel from the Mishnah and Challah, where the Mishnah and Challah describes that you could potentially create bread out of both rice and wheat. And the Yerushalmi has explanation of that, where the Yerushalmi says that the rice is nigrar, it's drawn after the wheat. And Rav Lichtenstein explains, this is a whole shiur for another time, based off Rav Chaim Brisker's approach to that in his Chibur on the Rambam, that what is the lumdus, what's going on when the rice is drawn after the wheat? There are certain types of grains or products that may not be able to become bread themselves, but because they're similar in construct, they're similar enough that when combined with something that actually can be bread, it itself becomes bread as well. You could be yotzei your mitzvah of matzah with it. The rice itself becomes bread. It's nigrar, it's drawn after. And Rav Lichtenstein explained that there are certain things in secular culture on the outside of our walls that could be drawn into the Torah world, that can be very valuable in being nigrar, achar the Torah, and can incorporate and become part of our bread, a part of what Torah stands for. And it highlights certain aspects of the Torah that we would be unsensitized to otherwise. Rav Lichtenstein was a very strong believer that it's not Torah and per se, even though that is what he's talking about in this essay, but rather it shows us more about the Torah than we didn't understand already. Certain aspects of secular culture that we could draw in. But you can only make those decisions when you're already an insider. You can't determine what's considered nigrar after grain if you're already standing in the rice paddies. You need to be standing inside the walls. And if you want the Torah to be like rice, or like any other random vegetable that happens to catch your fancy, then it's not going to work. You're not going to make the right cheshbon. You're going to start trying to incorporate things in the Torah that don't belong. They're not nigrar. It doesn't shtim. It doesn't fit together. But you're going to force it. And you're going to insist that it really does belong. And that's when Torah starts getting manipulated, changed, emphases get thrown off. And suddenly now, certain things that were never a value suddenly become a value and placed into the Torah, forced into the Torah. And that is a debasement of the Torah. The Torah doesn't need to conform to general culture. It doesn't need to change anything. We, from a place of strength, we determine what should be incorporated into the Torah. And from a place of strength, we translate the Torah to share our wisdom with others. Not because we're ashamed of it, not because we're nervous about what the outside world thinks. From a place of pride, from a place of knowing that our Torah is the essence of the universe and needs to be shared with every single human being on the face of this planet so that they can know what it means to be a Tzelem Elokim. But if it's all about trying to translate the Torah into the terms of secular society and manipulating Torah, making sure that it stims, trying to make rice into what it's not, it doesn't work. And ultimately debases the Torah. I think we need to ask ourselves whether we're insiders or outsiders. We need to be, are we proud of our Torah Masorah? Do we stand with pride? Or are we ashamed of our Masorah? Are we nervous about what the outside world thinks of us? Are we nervous about what other Jews think about us? Even worse, do we want to amend it? Do we want to place slight emphases on various different things that don't really belong? Want to make a little bit of edits so that it could be nigger after the modern trends, maybe a little bit more, that it could fit a little? The Torah doesn't need to prove itself. It doesn't need to do anything. Nasa v'nishma is what our ancestors cried out, and we also, without qualification, with total loyalty, need to say, be'emunah shleima, nasa v'nishma. We're in the Ribbono Shel Olam. We're inside the walls. We're not surrounding it. We are insiders and always will be insiders. And it doesn't mean that you can't have questions. It doesn't mean that you can't feel uncomfortable sometimes with what you see on the inside. But an insider can properly struggle with those questions. An outsider wants to change what the Torah has to say. An insider wants to struggle with it, wants to find answers, wants to know what a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Chachma truly is. We need to break the siege. Let's break the siege. We might be outsiders who are surrounding the walls. In many ways, I think all of us are. We all grew up in a modern milieu. We grew up with Western culture. In many ways, we grew up more like non-Jewish neighbors than some of our Jewish neighbors who live in Eretz Yisrael. We need to remind ourselves that ultimately we are insiders. Na'aseh v'nishma. We have total commitment to Torah. Instead of feeling insecure in our beliefs, let's proudly project them to the entire world. Wish everybody a meaningful fast. Something to consider over the course of Aseret B'Teves. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming.